Welcome to the Jeffers Brief, only on Contra Radio Network.
And hello again, John Jeffers here at the Jeffers Brief on Contra Radio Network on KYAK and KNAK. Welcome to another episode. Tonight, or today, depending on when you're listening to this, I want to talk about a couple things, ones that get me crazy. None really have anything to do with the other, except when you look at the big picture. And you're saying, John, what's the big picture? And I'm going to tell you, I don't know. Because back in the 90s, and you were an employee, and you asked your supervisor, hey, why do we need to do it this way, or why are we doing this? The manager invariably would say, well, you just don't get the big picture. And most of us go, oh, okay, well, we'll just do it. But this, people like myself at one point in time, when I decided that I'm not going to do that anymore, especially when I was working at the sheriff's office, I said, why are we doing this? This policy makes no sense. It's irrelevant. It's useless. Why are we doing it? And the sergeant and lieutenant, the shift commander looked at me and said, well, Deputy Jeffers, you just don't get the big picture. I said, but wait. Why don't you explain to me what the big picture is? I want to be a team player. So please tell me what the big picture is so I can be a team player. Oh. And then they looked at me, and you know that look you get? The famous if looks could kill? I would have been massacred right there in their office. And then they told me to get out. But, the point is just that. What's the big picture? I don't know what the big picture is. I don't know. I don't. However, I was watching that new show on CBS. It's called The Neighborhood. I was just, what are we looking at? Yeah, let's see what we can find here. And, in fact, it was the episode right before Thanksgiving last month. And one of the main characters had his mother coming into town for a visit, so the white male character ran over to his new neighbors, who are a family of black Americans, and explained to him, look, when you come over to the house, my mom's going to be there, and this is, and it just struck me, and it started me thinking, but anyways, so the character says, well, my mother's coming into town. She has some pretty, conservative idea. And before he could get it out, the other character, the mother, if you will, in the black American family household, pipes up and says, oh, racist? And, of course, cue the canned laughter. And I'm thinking, I'm really starting to get irritated by this. So I started talking to a couple of my friends. Some think like me, some do not. They're still my friends. Some actually vote Democratic. They're still my friends. Do we talk about politics? Sometimes. Do we think the other is out of their mind? Absolutely. So, I explained to them the story I just told you. And you know what? It was very interesting. They did say it word for word, but the gist of the subject, their main idea, if you will, was that they see it too. And that is this. Hollywood, whether it's in film or in television, is you're going to start seeing them push more and more of the, what I would consider the liberal culture war. You will start to see, if you haven't already, more of a positive LGBT push. And they want to keep showing this over and over again, and this is just one example of how normal it is. Look how normal it is. And they do it over and over and over again across the spectrum. Why? Because that way you become immune to it. Look, I don't care about the LGBT population. I don't. It doesn't affect me. It has nothing to do with me. And if, you know, you want to live that life, that's up to you. And you get all that it means. You get to experience all of it. And in the end, I think, you know, let's put it this way. I won't be the one standing in front of the throne on Judgment Day and explaining. Look, I got enough to explain for. That's not one of the things I want to have to account for. Thank you. But that's what Hollywood's doing. You're going to start seeing more of this idea that being poor is noble. Being successful means you're greedy. That kind of thing. Everything that is really, I guess what you want to do, you could call the core values of, say, middle America, flyover country. And they want to keep doing it over and over and over again, so you become anesthetized to it, and that you just say, oh, well, oh, yeah, that's normal. That's all right. You know, case in point, that show Murphy Brown, I hated it when it was on. I think I watched it twice when it was on 20 years ago. And I find it very interesting that because we have a conservative president who's not afraid to say that America needs to be number one, all of a sudden they resurrect the show from the grave, from beyond. You know, it's like, really? And now, even though the writers and their interviews say, oh no, we just write about what we see happening in the political world. Really? You can divine stuff 6 months ahead of time? Amazing. Amazing. It's nonsense. And they keep pushing that the state is great. The state is number one. You must adhere to what the state tells you. No more thinking. It will be anti-free speech, anti-Second Amendment, and it goes on and on. But again, they do it intentionally. Again, intentionally to anesthetize you to anything. So when it does happen and you do lose your Second Amendment rights and you do lose your First Amendment rights, and you will, you just think, oh, okay. And I have to tell you, I did see a post on the CRN Facebook page. I don't like Facebook, but because that's the majority of people doing the social media, I go there to try and pump up, get people to listen to the shows on Contra Radio Network. And I just, like, what is going on here? And I just don't like it. But one of the things that came up was, why is it conservatives always seem to be losing the culture war? Well, I think it's pretty easy just to look at. One, Republicans are terrible about packaging their message. They're terrible with it. I'm not saying the Democrats are better, but they're better at packaging their message than the Republicans are. And I think we also have to look at another thing, too. You know, we look at the mainstream media. I call them the lapdogs. You know, 70% of conservatives, over 70%, almost 77, 80% of conservatives do not trust the mainstream media. The number's a lot lower amongst the liberal-leaning viewers. And I'm thinking to myself, what is... This is why we lose. We don't hold people accountable. They get these liberals, newscasters, and don't forget, they don't write their stories. They don't. What they do is they just read what's put on the teleprompter right in front of them. So they're not even listening. I mean, they're not even writing their own stories. It's much like you see these people, the Hollywood actors and actresses, who think that Middle America gives a damn about their opinions on politics, on anything. And those people that do pay attention to what the what I would call the professional the professional pretenders, because that's what they are, their job is to pretend to be somebody they're not. Let's play pretend and get make and let's get paid for it. Oh yeah. And they believe in the nonsense that's, you know, that their characters are. Well, it's real easy to believe that, oh, we should have immigration reform, we should have open borders, let them in, because, you know, when you live behind a gated community and you don't have the possibility of bad things happening to you or your family, it makes it easier to say, I got lots of money, I can live behind a gated community, which provides me security, or let's put it another way, they live behind a wall. A wall for me, but not for thee. So I wanted to know, and I'm not picking on the gay population, but I wanted to know this. I went to Gallup, and I wanted to know, what is the estimated percentage of the LGBT community as in the population? Well, according to Gallup, and this was taken on May 22nd, 2018. This is the latest one I could find. The percentage of American adults identifying as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender increased to 4.5% in 2017, up from 4.1% in 2016 and 3.5% in 2012 when Gallup began tracking the measure. The latest estimate is based on over 340,000 interviews conducted as part of Gallup's daily tracking in 2017. So their Gallup's LGBT estimates are based on those respondents who say yes when asked, do you personally identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender? Extrapolation to the latest census estimate of adults 18 and older in the U.S. suggests that more than 11 million adults identify as LGBT in the country today. Now, you say, well, why are you bringing that up? And I'll tell you why. Remember a few years back when there was a big push for gay rights and whatnot? And you listen to the news, you would think that that percentage of the population, that particular identity of the population, were the majority. And it turns out they're not as big as a majority as the news, the lapdogs, would have you believe. So that's why I just brought it up. I wanted to find out, this is what it is. Now, in 2017, this is what it's kind of interesting. 5.1% of the women in 2017 identified as LGBT compared with 3.9% of the men. The change among men over time has been minimal, with the LGBT percentage edging up 3.4% in 2012 to 3.7% last year and this year. On the other hand, the percentage of women identifying as LGBT has risen from 3.5% in 2012 to 5.1% today, with the largest jump occurring between 2016 and 2017. If you want to break it down by race or ethnicity, white, non-Hispanic, 4% in 2017, black, non-Hispanic, 5%, Hispanic, 6.1%, and Asian, non-Hispanic, 4.9%. That's in 2017. Just stuff, if you'd like to look it up, you'll find it in Gallup. Go to the Gallup website, gallup.com, estimated LGBT population. And you can find their numbers there. And it breaks it down by education and as well as income. But, like I said, it wasn't so much to castigate the LGBT community as it was to say, what is up with the mainstream media? Like I said, you listen to the mainstream media and you would think they are certainly close to being what we would consider to be the majority, or a larger block of voters than they really are. Just want to put it out there. Yes, I know I'm going to get hate mail. I know. I get it. All right? I get it. I don't care. Now, one thing I want to talk to you about before we get to the other stuff. Have you ever heard of something called ballot harvesting? Have you heard of it? Well, I'd like to take a moment here and let's talk about it, because this is how it was used in the California elections. Ballot harvesting is a political jargon for a practice in which organized workers or volunteers collect absentee ballots from certain voters and drop them off at a polling place or election office. So, what is ballot harvesting and how is it used in California elections? Well, it was used. They even admit to it. Okay, well, that explains it. Shall we talk about it? Yes, let's do that. From the San Diego Union Tribune, they did a story. It's about today. It was out a week ago, December 10th. In the wake of last month's blue wave that wrested control of the House from Republicans and transferred to the Democratic Party, some members of the GOP, which, by the way, is an acronym which means Grand Old Party, are complaining about the results and the practice of so-called ballot harvesting in California. In the most high-profile example, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican, Wisconsin, said last week that California defies logic and that he can't begin to understand what ballot harvesting is. What is it, and why should you know? So, as we talked about, the issue of ballot harvesting also captured the media spotlight this week in North Carolina, where the practice is not allowed, and where the results of its 9th congressional district race are under scrutiny in light of allegations of election fraud. You heard me. North Carolina's State Board of Elections is now investigating those allegations, but the practice of so-called ballot harvesting itself is not illegal. So here's a point-by-point explanation of why it is legal and how it worked in California, and whether it played a role in the Democrats flipping historically Republican districts. Now, I told you the definition is, we'll say it again, it's political jargon for a practice in which organized workers or volunteers collect absentee ballots from certain voters and drop them off at a polling place or election office. Coined by California Republicans, the term carries a negative connotation to suggest improprieties and even election fraud. See, this is the problem. Right here, I'll stop right here. Right there is a perfect example of bias in the media. They say the term was coined by California Republicans. Got no problem with that. And that it carries a negative connotation to suggest improprieties or even election fraud. Well, no kidding. Really? If I'm going to pick up ballots in only this part of the district that I know will benefit my candidate of my choosing, and not pick up any other ballots, just those ballots and deliver them, well, wouldn't anybody with an ounce of common sense think that, yeah, that's a bad thing, that it is impropriety? I mean, really. So the conservative site townhall.com called it the California Democrats' latest election-stealing tool. The San Francisco Chronicle editorial board took a different view, calling it a sinister-sounding way of saying their opponent turned out more votes than they did in one recent editorial. Is it legal? Yes. In 2016, Governor Moonbeam, Jerry Brown, signed into law a change to Section 3017 of the Election Code that allows any person to collect a mail-in ballot from voters and turn in the mail ballot to a polling place or the registrar's office. Prior law restricting the practice to just relatives or those living in the same household as the voter. Well, while critics decry it as a practice of a banana republic, proponents of the change say it allows more eligible citizens to participate in the election across California. So here's how the legislation spells out the practice. All right, here we go. Section A. All vote by mail ballots cast under this division shall be voted on or before the day of election. After marking the ballot, the vote by mail voter shall do any of the following. 1. Return the ballot by mail or in person to the elections official from whom it came. 2. Return the ballot in person to a member of a precinct board at a polling place within the jurisdiction. Or 3. Return the ballot to the elections official from whom it came at a vote-by-mail drop-off location if provided pursuant to Section 3025. However, a vote-by-mail voter who is unable to return the ballot, and here you go, this is the big one, bold, highlighted, may designate any person to return the ballot to the elections official from whom it came or to the precinct board at a polling place within the jurisdiction. The ballot must, however, be received by either the elections official from whom it came or the precinct board before the close of the polls on election day. Now the question becomes, did ballot harvesting take place in California's elections? Anecdotally, news reports have so far identified one county where the practice was noticed. Orange County's Register of Voters, Neil Kelly, told the San Francisco Chronicle that the county certainly had that going on here, with people dropping off maybe 100 or 200 ballots. Fred Whitaker, the chairman of the Republican Party in Orange County, told supporters that GOP losses in the county were the direct result of ballot harvesting allowed under California law for the first time, the Chronicle reported. Did ballot harvesting amount to election fraud in California? Well, there have been no credible reports of ballot harvesting beyond employed illegally or systematically to amount to election fraud. The AP reported that Democrats have scoffed at theories of election fraud, and Secretary of State Alex Padilla, guess what? Yeah, that's right. He's a Democrat, was quoted saying that the laws don't benefit one party over the other. So, did ballot harvesting help Democrats win big? Well, Ryan's comments indicate Republicans outside California were caught off guard by the practice. Those inside the state say they were not surprised, and some even commended the Democrats. To say we were caught flat-footed by this is just not true, California GOP spokesman Matt Fleming told Fox News. We were well aware of this. We even did it ourselves. We pay attention to election laws. Dale Neubauer, a veteran Republican consultant, told the Chronicle that Democrats use the practice in a thorough and disciplined ground game. Absolutely, ballot harvesting played a very significant role, Neubauer told the Chronicle, adding that I have a little bit of professional admiration for how well the Democrats executed their plan. Ballot harvesting is allowed in North Carolina. So the question then becomes this. How do we know that anybody, this is why I hate mail ballots. It's a ploy. Who's to say that Mr. Jones, who passed away in April, but for some reason he's still on the voter rolls, and say that his son or daughter or wife or whatever, you know, they mail out the ballot. I got one. I personally got one. I threw it in the mail. I said, no, I will go to the poll on election day and I will vote. I can take 10 minutes out of a 12 to 14 hour time period to vote, to participate in the electoral process. The problem becomes this. So Mr. Jones, who died in April, his wife, son, or daughter get the ballot, and they fill it in, and then and you know they return it. We have election fraud right there. Mr. Jones is dead. How did he fill out his ballot? Well, I don't know. No one seems to know. And that's the problem. It's also why we need voter ID. If you need an ID to get on a plane, don't you think you should have one for voting? Just saying. Now, I did hear something interesting, and I want to share it with you listeners. You know, we hear about how over in New Jersey they're banning large capacity magazines. You know, right now they're limited to 10, then it'll be 5, then it'll be 2, then it'll be 1. Yeah, you can carry one, but you can't have it. You can't have it. It's got to be in the chamber. You can't have it before it becomes none. It's just the way it works. It's mission creep, a little bit at a time, incrementalism, as Bill Clinton, the former president of the United States, said. You can't get it all in one bite. You got to do it incrementally, a little bit, little bit, little bit. And he's absolutely right. That's how you get it done. And that's what's happening in New Jersey. So anyways, there's that. You know, sometimes I get myself going so fast I don't even keep up with it. Anyways, where was I? What I'm saying is this. It's not going to cost, you know, when the state says we will pay you, you know, we'll pay for your voter ID as a citizen, it would guarantee only citizens can vote. Maybe there'll be some people that would be willing to maybe give a voter ID to people they're not supposed to. Voter fraud will still occur, but it will cut down on quite a bit of what we see. I find it interesting that we have many people of a political party saying, well, you're just going to disenfranchise the voters. No. If requiring people to have a voter ID to ensure that only the proper people are allowed to vote in an election, is that not preserving the vote? Making it less likely that there is, shall we say, voter fraud going on? How many stories have we seen on occasion that pop up about somebody who decided to vote for they got their mother's, or they got one of their parents' ballots, they voted by mail, and then they went to one precinct and voted, and then showed up at their parents' voting precinct because they're across town and voted for their parents, who are invalids and couldn't get out of the house. And eventually, the paper, you know, paper trail eventually catches up to them. We've seen that. It does happen. And it is happening. So what's the problem with trying to preserve the vote? There's one political party that swears up and down you'll disenfranchise the voters. Yeah, that's right. It's the Democrat Party. And why is it that they are so intent to keep voter ID from becoming law? Well, it's pretty simple. If you can't keep voting at different precincts around the town or the city, that means you can only vote once. But that's, you know, we've seen it. It's happening. It does happen. All right. Where am I in this? How much? Ah, good. All right. That's ballot harvesting. When you hear it, that's what it is. Did it play a part? I'm sure it did. Again, you know, and here's another thing. What is this about, oh, we got provisional ballots coming in after the election, you know, after the election's over, a week after the election's over, or 3 days, 4 days after the election's over, we have to count every vote. No, you do not. If you chose to mail your ballot 2 days before the election, you know it's not going to get through on the mail in time. You know it's not. So do yourself a favor, and everyone else, stop pretending you're going to get it there in the mail, and it should be counted after the election. When election day is over, it's over. No more, you know, if you don't have it in by that time, oh well, too bad. Better luck next time. Or you can be like myself and just choose to go to your polling place on election day and vote then and there. But there are people out there who still believe, oh no, this motor voter. Yeah, right. Give me a break. Next. This is kind of interesting. You know, the Spectator magazine, something very interesting here. And they wrote an article on December 14th. It's called Why Ballot Harvesting Must Be Made Illegal. And unlike Stacey Abrams, the Democrat sore loser in Georgia, Bill Nelson, the Democrat sore loser in Florida, Hillary Clinton in her year 2016 Democrat sore losers, and Al Gore in his year 2000 Democrat sore losers, I accept the Democrats have obtained the House seats they flipped in Orange County and elsewhere in California after tons of come-from-behind votes were tallied many days after Election Day. This article therefore looks ahead to infinity and beyond. In particular, all 50 states rapidly must act to ban ballot harvesting. Sifting through the mystery of a blue house wave in a still Republican blood orange county. Who wrote this? Dove Fisher. He says, I live in Orange County. It is so conservative red here that I call it blood orange county. I have been persuaded that the number count is accurate. For this, I acknowledge the input of several, including those whom I will identify as DJB, Adam P., Stephen Greenhut, and Stuart P. But I also know that this Orange County, with the exception of one predominantly Latino community in Santa Ana, continues to be conservative red and blood orange county, notwithstanding Democrats' House flips. Yes, the OC is not as broadly conservative as it was, say, a half century ago. And as someone acutely aware of this, echo chambers in which leftists cocoon themselves on American campuses, in Hollywood, on Broadway, in pseudo-journalism and other such venues, I am self-aware enough to ask myself, is it perhaps only within my own circles here that conservatism flourishes? Yet I am satisfied to answer that my impressionistic perceptions are validated by my surroundings, daily encounters, and public political activity here. It is in the people whom I encounter randomly and daily, but otherwise would not know, at the supermarket and drugstore, at the coffee house, the people I randomly encounter while walking to synagogue on the Sabbath day. I recognize it in Peter, who frames artwork beautifully for my home, in John, who has been my handyman for 15 years, and who purchases my congregation's shemets every Passover. In the man who is my electrician and my plumber and the guy who zaps the spiders and ants, Nick comes to paint and we discuss Reagan politics. Most of my doctors, they're all conservative Republicans. I meet their customers and patrons at their stores primarily conservative. I do not pick them for their politics. They just all happen to be Republicans because that is the local demographic here in Blood Orange County. Of course, there are many liberals here too. This is not the Soviet Union, Venezuela, or any Arab Muslim country where 98% of the voters cast their ballots one way and the other 2% are sentenced to 30 years of hard labor. Of course, there's a dichotomy, with perhaps 40 to 45% of the locals being more Democrat and liberal oriented. Indeed, my recognizing that phenomenon and those people reflects that I am not viewing the current here monolithically through a tunneled vision. It is just that this region is politically conservative. It just still is. Now, some liberal judge tried to force a homeless encampment here. No one needed Rasmussen or Gallup to survey local attitudes. The local leftists tried an Occupy Irvine thing here. It was pathetic, with maybe 15 or 20 people, mostly out-of-town students from the local University of California outpost here. Youths who visit the OC for 4 to 6 years, depending on how long they need to grow up and get finished with the college with a bachelor's degree, majoring in identity studies and minoring in boycotting Israel and harassing Jewish students. So what happened in November that turned the House seats blue? A few things. Money, 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 and shifting realities. First of all, out-of-towners Tom Steyer, Michael Bloomberg, and others of their ilk pumped millions of dollars into the region's House races just before the elections. They bought millions in ads, campaign workers, phone bank volunteers, and mailers for the Democrats. The hapless California GOP was blindsided, while the national Republican congressional effort was caught flat-footed. Republicans need to understand that politics is cyclical and realities flip. It used to be that white, ethnic, Catholic, blue-collar immigrants were a lock for Democrats. As one example, the 1855 Louisville riots saw at least 22 and perhaps hundreds of Irish and German-American immigrants murdered on Bloody Monday by locals who were stirred up to stop those new immigrants from voting for Democrats. West Virginia once was solidly Democrat. It used to be, until the 1970s, that the Democrats had a century-long lock on the entire Deep South. But time heals, and those locks have flipped. Even among Jews, the Orthodox Jewish community, the fastest-growing American Jewish demographics, and slated to be the Jewish majority in the coming decades, now is overwhelmingly pro-Trump Republican conservative. Even as Jews now have shifted overwhelmingly throughout the world to affiliate with conservatives from England to Israel. On the other hand, Virginia, the seat of the Confederacy after it moved its capital from Montgomery, now is becoming Democrat as D.C. left-oriented political activists move to nearby suburbs, and the California that gave us Nixon and Reagan is lost to the GOP for the next generation as a result of the porous southern border that the Republicans never firmed. In the same cyclical way, the Democrats now have shifted into the party of big money, Wall Street money, Silicon Valley money. That money now is Democrat. Other than Sheldon Adelson and a few others, big money is no longer the provenance of the GOP. Rather, the Republicans now have become the party of the middle class, the union workers, though not their bosses, and pensioner seniors who were campus radicals in the late 60s. The GOP must confront this new reality. The Democrats buried them in campaign spending on House races. That played a role in House flips. Number three, D.C. Republicans wasted 2 years, proved unable to govern, and forgot to address health care and immigration. Well, it's true, they did. They forgot. Washington Republicans promised for years to repeal and replace Obamacare, and they lied. It was insufficiently merely to end Obama's individual mandate. Beyond repealing Obamacare, the need still existed to solve the health insurance crisis and adequately to cover pre-existing conditions. Stop here, take a quick note. Do you remember? That was the Democrats' main hammering point on the Republicans. They're not going to cover pre-existing conditions. Let's get back to it. In past decades, Republicans were the party of the rich, white, shoe country club set. The Romneys and Bushes and billionaire Koch brothers types. Those Republicans kowtowed to the corporate sorts who have no problem importing illegals and overrunning our southern border with cheap, undocumented labor in order to maximize their profits while choking off the wages of low-income American citizens, including hard-working people of color. In that past, such economic issues as health care, Social Security, retirement income were concerns of the Democrats. The party of the white union workers and seniors, while Rhino Republicans utterly did not care. But Ronald Reagan and then Donald Trump have transferred the GOP into the party of the working stiffs and the middle class. The union workers, the ethnic Catholic and blue-collar laborers who work 40-hour weeks for a living and pass it on down the line, and seniors, those hard workers pay the taxes that sustain this economy. They have earned the right to expect results on health care reform. They are entitled to care about retirement and Social Security because they worked hard and paid into it all their lives. Although welfare is not an entitlement and food stamps are not an entitlement, no matter what Obama called it, a secure Social Security pension is an entitlement because the recipients paid for it. The white shoe Republicans in Washington forgot about those voters and their imperative for health care reform. Remember how proud Republicans were when companies started announcing $1,000, $2,000 bonuses after the Trump tax cuts passed? Remember how Republicans rightly mocked Nancy Pelosi when she dismissed that money as crumbs? So what about a healthcare system where a responsible person does not wait until he or she is sick to buy insurance, but responsibly buys coverage proactively when young and maintains it responsibly for decades? buying a good plan that covers 80% of all physician, medical, and pharmaceutical costs, with the patient paying only 20%. Good, right? Right? And then what happens when someone in the family tragically is stricken with a severe disease later? Heart disease, organ failure, cancer, and suddenly finds that even that excellent health care plan leaves the uninsured household with an out-of-pocket add-on cost of $5,000 to $10,000 per year. Republicans in Washington forgot to address this financial reality. Just as it is not crumbs to get a $1,000 or $2,000 pay bonus as part of a tax cut, it is also not insignificant when a hardworking, responsible taxpayer gets hit annually with an out-of-pocket $5,000 to $10,000 add-on health cost each year, beyond the premiums for good insurance. The D.C. Republicans never addressed fixing health care after repealing the obscene Obamacare mandate. They forgot the critical third world of repeal and replace. How will those stricken randomly, through no fault of their own, with outlier high-cost diseases, be protected by the same social net that rightly protects other victims randomly and by acts of God? Likewise, Washington Republicans never solved the border crisis. They did not resolve DACA, whether to legalize all of them, deport all of them, or something in between. They did not allocate the needed wall funding. They did not tighten the border securely enough to keep out the scourges of opioids, human trafficking, MS-13 animals, and outright terrorists. You know what? Don't insult the animals with equating them to MS-13. They dropped the ball all over the place as though it were New Year's Eve at Times Square. They did not govern. If it were not for President Trump achieving so much unilaterally, driving through fabulous judicial nominations, deregulating the economy by executive authority, conducting a muscular foreign policy, recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and moving our embassy there, staring down the priggish Europeans over their NATO cheap penny pinching, and staring down ISIS and others, the past 2 years would have been a complete waste. So that explains more of the votes than Republican House candidates lost locally to Democrats. In addition, California Republicans knew there would be a political price exacted when Congress decided to pay for the Trump tax cuts, in part by reducing the amount of property taxes and mortgage interest that Californians herein can deduct on their 1040 filings. That financial consideration, too, cost local Republican candidates votes among independents. Even though Republican-aligned voters accepted the hit not only as a sacrifice for the common good, but also as an investment from which they ultimately would benefit under a revived and booming post-Obama economy they know would ensue. Number four, harvesting ballots. The Democrats control everything in California, so cheated by corrupting the election rules. The big kicker, the freeway robbery, emerges as harvesting of ballots. Now that ballot harvesting is on the national radar, it must be stopped elsewhere. Here is what outgoing Democrat Governor Jerry Brown, once known as Governor Moonbeam and still is, approved in a Poletti that exploited the porous southern border so that Democrats control all statewide offices, control both legislative houses with supermajorities, therefore can implement absolutely anything they want unless stopped by the United States Supreme Court. Now, on Election Day in California, you can go vote in person. Alternatively, you can mail in your ballot. Your mail or ballot consists of pages with pre-printed names with little circles or bubbles printed alongside them. With dark ink, you fill in your selected bubbles, sign your name, date your ballot, you put it into the envelope, seal the envelope, sign and date that too. You then have to bring it into a voting facility by no later than Election Day, or you may affix a postage stamp and mail the envelope. The envelopes will be counted as long as they arrive, no later than 3 days after Election Day, as long as postmarked by Election Day. That means you fathom who's running and for what office. You also ferret through numerous statewide and local ballot propositions. There are also numerous unknowns running for judgeships and county school boards and water boards and local communities. For many in the electorate, the ballot is so overwhelming that they do not vote. Now, indeed, I urge those overwhelmed just to vote for the governor, the House, and the state legislature seats, and to skip the rest of the ballot. Ultimately, you have to, 1, fill in the bubbles, 2, sign the ballot, 3, date it, 4, seal it in the envelope, 5, get a postage stamp, 6, sign the envelope, 7, date the envelope, 8, get the sealed envelope, mailed or hand-delivered, It does not sound hard, but is it a real mega pain? This explains partly why so many do not vote. The propositions are near impossible to decipher. They are deliberately written to say the opposite of what they mean because proponents want to emphasize the short-term benefits while hiding how much each proposition ultimately will cost or what it really aims to change. Despite all that, responsible voters get their ballots done, find the stamps, and somehow get to the post office before the deadline. Now, this is where the large-scale cheating comes in. On this moonbeam harvest, they now allow ballot harvesting here. That means, on first blush, that a volunteer can offer to take a sealed, signed, and dated envelope and mail it or drop it off for the trusting voter. But the reality actually penetrates deeper. The volunteer may even offer to provide the postage stamp. Is that a bribe? Who will know? And who will be any the wiser if the moonbeam harvester even offers the by and by to fill in the bubbles for the voter? Who will know? The ballot, after all, does not entail handwriting the choices, just filling in the circles. So if the voter is a relative newcomer, let's even assume legally, which is an assumption here in California, but let's assume reasonably that the voter is not so adept in English, does not speak it or read it. Well, now you have this moonbeam harvester in the voter's home, offering not only to advance the postage stamp and take the envelope and drop it off or mail it, but even to fill in the bubbles for the voter who does not know English or otherwise has no time to ferret. Welcome to moonbeam harvesting. Waiting for the harvest and the time of reaping, we shall come rejoicing, bringing votes stuffed inside our sleeves. By and by, the harvest and the neighbor friended, we shall come rejoicing, bringing votes stuffed inside our sleeves. Number 5. In conclusion, how blood orange temporarily shaded blue. So what color is the dress? White and gold? Blue and black? In November, blood orange county seemed to turn blue, but the denizens are still blood orange. Alas, Republicans were caught flat-footed on campaign financing. The GOP dropped the ball on health care and pre-existing conditions and on out-of-pocket add-on health costs that were not crumbs. They blew it on immigration, DACA, and the wall. They fell on a sword for reducing Form 1040 deductions for property taxes and home mortgage interest. And the same hapless state GOP, which missed the ball when California changed its primary balloting system to the jungle primary, again went AWOL when the Democrats of California changed balloting rules so that the votes could be delivered by Harvest Moonbeam volunteers, opening the door to other forms of election fraud. Harvesting ballots must be banned. I like it. I thought it was very well written. I thought it explained it very well. And why? I don't think he's wrong at all, do you? Well, I don't. I don't think he's wrong. Let's see here. We've got about 11 more minutes here. All right. What do I want to do here? The following is, where is it? Let me see if I want to fire off on this one. General Flynn will be sentenced tomorrow. Very interesting. I'm going to play for you here. The first thing you're going to hear will be Fox News host. What's his name? He's Fox News host. He's talking to Rudy Giuliani. Chris Wallace. Chris Wallace is talking to Giuliani. And then you'll hear Dershowitz with another host in a few seconds. So I want to play it for you so you get an idea. So you're always up to speed.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck. After what they did to Flynn, the way they trapped him into perjury, and no sentence for him, 14 days for Papadopoulos, I did better on traffic violations than they did with Papadopoulos.
So when you say good luck, you're saying no interview.
They're a joke over my dead body.
Giuliani now had a lot to say over the weekend. What do we need to understand about this week? Alan Dershowitz wrote the book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, and the professor's with me now. Sir, good to have you back. Good morning to you. Over my dead body. I think it was the quote of the weekend. Pretty much tells us it's not going to happen. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. I think every reasonable defense attorney would give the same advice. We remember very carefully the Martha Stewart case, where they got her for talking to the FBI, and then Flynn. Look, the Flynn case is fascinating. I hope the judge understands when he has the case tomorrow that Flynn did not commit a crime by lying, because the lie has to be material to the investigation. And if the FBI already knew the answer to the question and only asked him the question in order to give him an opportunity to lie, his answer, even if false, was not material to the investigation.
Which raises
lying
the question,
why, to the FBI is not a crime.
Why do you lie? I mean, why not just tell the truth, especially if everybody knew what was going on? Just quickly on Giuliani. You saw him on Fox with Chris Wallace. You saw him on ABC with Stephanopoulos. Did he show any cards in either of those interviews, do you think?
Well, I think he is... made it very clear the president's finished cooperating. He understands this is an adversarial hearing, that Mueller will do anything to try to get people to sing or perhaps even to compose, and that cooperation is now off the table. It was on the table early on in the investigation, and then it became clear to the Trump defense team that cooperation was getting them nowhere, that they were determined to get Trump by squeezing all the people around him. So I think the cards that were shown yesterday were that this investigation, as far as Trump's concerned, is over unless they try to subpoena him. And then we have a constitutional conflict because Trump asserts Article 2 and other constitutional rights. We go to court and we don't have a Mueller report for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So I suspect we're on the way to a Mueller report, which will find no crimes, but will find political sins, which are not the proper function of a special counsel. The Inquisition found sins, but prosecutors are supposed to find only crimes.
Okay, now let's come back to Flynn. What do we need to understand about this sentencing tomorrow?
Well, two things. Number one, that I think the judge has the authority to throw out the plea if he believes that the plea was not to a crime. And I think he should find, as a matter of law, that when you tell an untruth to the FBI about a matter that they already know the truth about, they already know the answer, when the only purpose of the question is to get you to lie, that that's not a crime, that that's not a material misstatement. But if he doesn't find that, if he doesn't throw it out, and it would take a lot of courage to throw it out, I think we're seeing probably a probationary sentence. Whether we then see a pardon or a commutation afterward, that's a political issue. I'm not familiar with that.
Late on Friday, a lot of folks running around that afternoon, Mueller came out with a statement saying, with regard to these charges of entrapment, you know, a lot of pieces were written last week that Flynn was entrapped in this interview. Mm-hmm. And the special counsel came out and felt compelled to say, no, this was not entrapment. We were not there to set you mm-hmm. up. But what do you do? How did that strike you?
Well, I don't think that's right. I think a lot of people are misinterpreting the issue. The question, this, as Mueller put it, was, did he lie or was he treated unfairly? And the answer to that question is both are true. He did lie. He had the opportunity not to lie. Nobody could figure out why he would lie. He obviously knew there were transcripts. But the second question is, was he treated unfairly? The answer is absolutely yes. Told not to have a lawyer present, made to relax, made to feel that this was just an opportunity to kind of schmooze with some FBI buddies, and then they spring the trap on him. He fell for the trap, but they sprung the trap. They asked him a question to which they already knew the answer, not for purposes of learning the truth, they knew the truth, but for purposes of giving him an opportunity to lie. The question for the American public is, do we want the FBI to be springing morality tests on our citizens, criminal morality tests, giving them the opportunity to lie, giving them the opportunity to tell the truth? That's not a proper function of law enforcement, and I would hope the judge would see that and would say something about
okay,
that.
Okay, last point on that. I think the question had to do whether or not he talked to the Russian ambassador, right? And within his role, he would have had authority to do that, correct? So had they asked the
There's
question,
no question
he
that
said,
what he
yes,
did was
did.
Legal.
It was legal. So why
would
not
the end of the
tell
inquiry.
The truth about
yeah.
it?
You're absolutely right. He should have told the truth. You know, it leads to the possibility, it's just a possibility, that maybe he really was not lying. That's what the two FBI agents concluded. Maybe he just momentarily forgot. He didn't seem to be lying. He had no motive to lie. There was no reason to lie. He's an intelligent guy. Maybe he didn't lie. Maybe he told an untruth, which he believed was true at the time. I'm not saying that's the case, but certainly that's a possibility
okay,
that should be considered as well.
I'm well out of time. Will we get that answer tomorrow when Flynn appears?
I think we'll get some of those answers tomorrow. We won't be able to probe into his mind tomorrow. We'll still never know why a man with his background in intelligence, who knew that the FBI had the information, why he would not just say, hey, yeah, I did it. I'm proud of it. It was within my authority. Next question.
Okay. Unless he speaks tomorrow, we wait on that. Thank you, sir. Great stuff. Alan Dershowitz in Florida today. Thank you for being back here with us today. Thank
you. Well, there you have it. In a nutshell. Now, this just came over. How much time have I got left? Ooh, yeah, I got time. Make sure I got it all. Ah, yes, I do. All right. According to Sundance, Pienka and Strzok joint FBI notes are released. Judge Sullivan orders the Mueller team to file public version of the Pienka FBI interview, which is the 302 file that they hid. Now, this is interesting. On the eve of Michael Flynn's sentencing hearing tomorrow, Judge Emmett Sullivan, who's a really good guy, he really is, has ordered Robert Mueller's office to publicly file a redacted version of the original 302 interview notes that FBI agent Joe Pienka prepared after Flynn's January 24th, 2017 interview. Now, the analysis is this, really. It is highly unlikely any of the recent filings will modify the decision of Judge Sullivan. Rather, it appears to be an effort on his part to bring as much public disclosure to the forefront as possible prior to his ruling. Now, I'm still rather curious on whether we will ever find out why Judge Contreras, a friend of FBI agent Peter Strzok, was recused from the case immediately after accepting the plea on November 30th, 2017. Well, that's really something you really have to understand. Should I read that? Yeah. This is the electronic filing from the courts, the court clerk. This is entered on at 6:03 Eastern Daylight Time on December 17th, which is today. USA versus Flynn, case number 117CR00232. The document, docket text is this. Minute order as to Michael T. Flynn. On December 12, 2018, the court ordered the government to produce any 302s or memoranda relevant to the circumstances discussed on pages 7 through 9 of the defendant's sentencing memorandum. The government responded to the court's order under seal. Having reviewed the government's submissions, the court finds that the January 24, 2017 302, which was drafted immediately after Mr. Flynn's FBI interview, is relevant to Mr. Flynn's sentencing. The court also finds that the government's proposed redactions to that document are appropriate. As such, and in view of the strong public presumption in favor of public access to judicial records, see, for example, Nixon versus Warner Communications Incorporated, 435 U.S. 589-597, 1978, it is clear that the courts of this country recognize a general right to inspect and public and copy public records and documents, including judicial records and documents. And the court forthwith orders the government to file its proposed redacted version on the January 24th, 2017, 302 on the public docket, signed by Judge Emmett G. Sullivan on 12-17-2018. Yes. Tomorrow will be interesting. Very much so. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's show. What else we got coming up? I hope you got your Christmas stuff done, because that's important. You got to have your Christmas stuff done, your Christmas shopping. If you haven't, you got what, 10 days, roughly? Let's see. Yeah, you got a week from tomorrow, so you got 8 days to get it taken care of. Get that taken care of. Well, actually, yeah, got 8 days. It's the 17th. So you got that time to get your Christmas done. And if me saying Merry Christmas to you offends you, I don't care. Deal with it. I don't care. As a matter of fact, if you're offended by it, I'm offended that you're offended. So there, we think about that. All right. Anyways, I'm John Jeffers here at the Jeffers Brief, saying thank you for listening. Appreciate you taking the time to listen. And we'll see. We'll probably do our next show after Christmas. We won't do it beforehand because people will be traveling and whatnot. So we'll do our next show after Christmas, so it'll be probably Wednesday or Thursday of next week. I'm John Jeffers saying thank you. Appreciate you listening. Good night.